I am actor, comedian, gift queen, Danielle Radford.
And I'm writer, director, actor, and all-around horror fan, Megan Rosati.
Welcome to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, a Stage 13 original series that is an immersion into the unique worlds created by each episode of the hit anthology series on the CW and Netflix.
In each episode of our podcast, we sit down with the Two Sentence Horror Stories creators, as well as celebrity guests and social activists to deep dive into the social and cultural issues explored on the cult series.
And the carefully intricate craft that went into the making of each episode.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Guys, we gotta call the cops. There's an ambulance.
Get off me!
Shh! Listen.
People are coming.
What are we gonna do?
Grab the tent and get in the camper. Dude, we need to figure out what to do. We can't stay here.
What are you doing? Getting us the hell out of here!
Oh, yikes, wowzers. Hi, I'm Danielle Radford.
And I am writer, actor, director, and reanimated undead body, Megan Rosati.
That clip you just heard at the top was of Pete and his friends deciding to make yet another poor decision in the season 3 episode Toxic. Before we get into Toxic, Megan, my friend, how are you?
Danielle, my friend, I am so excited to be here. Co-hosting this podcast about Two Sentence Horror Stories with you. I was such
it's
a...
It's the first one! I'm so excited!
I'm so excited.
This season, we'll have a roster of amazing guest experts, writers, directors, yes, and cast members from this season of Two Sentence Horror Stories, as well as a few special guests to join us on the ride. I'm so excited.
And what's so cool is this is not just two horror girls fangirling out over the show. We'll also be talking with the social activists who are making a real world difference using the topics that Two Sentence Horror Stories brings up. So get excited to explore a bigger conversation. Today, we're discussing the season 3 episode Toxic, about a group of high school friends who enjoy one last party in the woods of the damned until a prank goes horribly wrong.
Damn it! Why are you always such a crybaby?
It was AJ! He opened his eyes!
What?
Brendan saw it too!
It was a reflex. Dead bodies do it all the time on TV. I've seen it.
Okay, we gotta call the cops! No one meant to kill AJ! Okay, they can't arrest us for an accident!
Are you kidding? The cops will take one look at our records and they won't care whether we did it or not.
Bunch of kids from the craft side of town. You can bet they're gonna blame us for what happened to AJ.
So what, we just sit around in the woods of the damned to become another ghost story?
Not unless we want to spend the rest of our lives in prison for something we didn't do.
You can check out this full episode on the CW as well as the CW app. With Toxic, we're going to explore the issue of toxic masculinity and how it harms not just men, but our entire community. We'll also talk about how we can better hold ourselves and others accountable and create a healthier version of what masculinity can look like.
Joining our conversation today, we have the director of the episode, Chase Joint.
Chase is a writer and director whose films have won awards internationally. His next documentary feature, Framing Agnes, is premiering at the 2022 Sundance Film Festival.
So dope. Chase returns to Two Sentence Horror Stories after directing the powerful season 2 episode, Elliot. Seriously, if you haven't done so already, go back, check out season 2's Elliot, which you can stream now on Netflix.
Later on in the show, we'll be joined by Josue Arguelles from A Call to Men. Josue is the director of youth initiatives and is responsible for facilitating Youth Act, a group of young leaders actively committed to promoting healthy masculinity and creating a better world for all people.
First up, Chase Joint. Chase, thank you so much for joining us today. Me and Megan are so excited because we loved Elliot, but you were kind of a little late to the horror genre before you directed that episode. And now you've done this one, which is also real good. Have your opinions about the genre changed any?
I have to be honest and say that my opinions about the genre haven't changed all that much since before I started. You know, I have spent a lot of time thinking about the representation of trans people in horror in particular, in films like, you know, Psycho and Silence of the Lambs and, you know,
Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, and these kinds of representations have had pretty horrific, you know, real world implications. And so for much of my life, I've turned away from the genre. And it was only through the invitation of Two Sentences to really think about that differently last season with Elliot that I made a turn and tried some things out.
And we're happy you did. I love Elliot. It's like one of my favorite episodes. It's so good.
Thank you.
So, Chase, you mentioned you're returning. So can you tell us, what did you learn from directing Elliot that you were able to bring into season 3's episode Toxic?
So, you know, the horror of Elliot can easily be summarized as being about the horror of surveillance and always being watched and always being looked at and always being surveilled and made sense of visually. And, you know, in that episode, we relied on mirrors and the architecture of a school and bathrooms to really make sense of that surveillance. You know, when I was first pitched Toxic, I was told it was about, you know, toxic masculinity and toxic friendship. But I immediately also read it as being about white supremacy and about white nationalism and about what happens when cohorts of men get together in unaccountable spaces. And so I started thinking, like, how can we use the woods as a character, similar to the ways in which we use the architecture of the school in Elliot? How do we use the woods as a structure or a playground in which we can explore these ideas and think about the stakes and consequences of our choices?
So is that kind of what drew you to the story, or was there anything else?
Oh yeah, men behaving badly. I think it's like just about time. It's funny, when I was talking to the showrunners and leadership, they were like, we thought you'd really enjoy this opportunity for critique. And I was like, oh yeah, like if we're gonna do this, if I'm gonna move toward anything about zombification of humans, I will do it under the guise of like thinking about misogyny and patriarchy and competition.
Oh, for sure. So as the director, what were you able to bring any parts of like your own personal experience and your own point of view to the vision of this episode?
Well, you know, I mean, as a trans person, I have spent much time on various sides of the gender binary. And, you know, let me tell you, you learn a lot from different vantage points. And, you know, I've witnessed toxic masculinity from an insider status, from an outsider perspective. And I think that, you know, the thing to take seriously in our episode is that the problem is not men, right? The problem is patriarchy. Patriarchy is a system that is designed to bolster privileges for some at the expense of others. And so I think this is one of those things that returns us to our conversation about genre, right? It'd be so easy to be like, oh, all men are bad. Well, that's like lazy and inaccurate. Like, what if we think about patriarchy as a system and all the ways in which things like school and governments and church, you know, reinforce who has the most power in all of those spaces?
Chase, as a director, I know you have to prepare for the episode. So can you talk to us about what it was like to prep for this episode? You know, what were your inspirations? What materials did you check out? And how were you able to get into the right headspace for a shooting?
You know, I spent a lot of time with my DP, Naeem Sutherland, and we talked a lot about comps, like what would the comps be for an episode like this? And we talked about Lord of the Flies, which I think is a very obvious referent, but also comps like Stand By Me, right? A kind of like campground, masculine, coming of age, cohort-based story. And, you know, we really settled into place where all of our choices were organized around momentum. So how do we make sure that the episode and the story keeps moving so that we never let the guys really have a chance to settle? And kind of through that pressure, how do we exteriorize all of these internal conflicts?
I'm a Pacific Northwest girl. I'm from Seattle. I love Vancouver so much. And it is such a beautiful, beautiful woodsy area. What was it like shooting out there?
Yeah, so, you know, I think like one of the glories of a set like ours is the endless possibilities for shooting. The complication of that is making sure that the woods feel specific. So making sure that we find different pockets so that the campground feels different than the crash site, feels different than the burial place? And how do you actually create architecture in space that can otherwise just feel like a densely wooded area? And so, you know, one of the ways that we did that is through playing with light. So where is the moon? Where is the atmosphere? And how can we use those things to communicate, you know, affect and feeling?
Right, because so much of this happens in like the middle of the night. Also, I'm sorry, I heard a rumor that y'all had like a bear scaring device. That is wild. Tell me about the bear scaring device. It's the only thing I want to talk about for the next 2 minutes.
Well, you know, at our safety meetings, it was made very clear that we should never wander off the trail, which is hilarious in the context of an episode like ours, right? Which is about continually wandering off the trail. But yes, I understand that there was a loud noise-making device and we had to be about careful about where our food was, you know, but of course bears are not particularly interested in film crews and would much prefer that we just leave them alone.
Coming up, more with our guests, but first, a word from our amazing sponsors. Welcome back to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast. So the characters in Toxic were so frustrating at times, to me at least. So how does each member of the friend group play a role in the toxic masculinity of the group overall?
Yeah, you know, I think the whole episode is riffing on archetypes and stereotypes. You know, we can identify the jock and the nerd and the hipster and the outsider, you know, but I think that the way that you can do that successfully is to not allow them to collapse into really flattened, easy go-to versions of sort of top-level stereotypes, and instead dig deep and think, like, what is actually motivating this person to be who they are? What are they trying to achieve by imagining themselves in a particular way? You know, the nerd has power because the nerd imagines himself to be nerdy for a reason. The jock has power because he imagines jockdom to open up access to different ways of being that make sense to him, right? So if we take those things seriously, and I think that's the difference between, you know, archetypes and stereotypes and characters, is like really playing with the nuances between there. How do we also give our characters chances to get out and watch them not take them over and over again? And I think that that's where the frustration comes, is because, you know, you want to attach to a good guy. You want someone to make a choice. And I think there are a few times in the episode where it almost happens and then
disappears.
And then it disappears because of peer pressure. And then there's that moment of, I really worked for this. And there's that entitlement of, I deserve this.
Wes is being super douchey.
Yeah, but that's Wes all the time.
No, but like he's been weird since I got into Yale.
That's because you're getting out. And his dad is pressuring him to enlist like his brothers. Pete, you're a friend, but you are different. Do you really want to be like us? A bunch of losers drinking beer at the corner dive and bitching about our dead-end lives.
How do you think that the horror genre in particular is a great way to tell those stories about succumbing to like all of that pressure and the consequences that come to succumbing to that pressure?
I mean, this is where horror really helps us, because horror loves to make exterior what is so often interior. So we get the reverse shot that clearly communicates consequences, and we can overinflate the impacts of these thoughts. So if we're thinking about the way in which Pete eventually destroys his friend, right? Sure, we could think about that as a real action, but we could also think about it like much more conceptually as the opportunity to witness him deteriorating under the pressure or succumbing to all of these forces and becoming a version of himself that he can't recognize anymore, or that, you know, he hates.
Over here at the pod, we love a good zombie tale. So what was the significance of the reanimated characters and how they behaved in the afterlife?
The reanimation, when I read it on the page and then when I thought about how to execute it visually, was both a wink and a kind of middle finger. You know, it kind of like reveals the horror of the playground, but also I think, you know, gestures to the way in which toxic masculinity and white supremacy and competition and a kind of like strive for power continues to consume us. And I think that in some ways we could also think about all these guys as a version of Pete. We could think about them separately, but we could also think about them as these kind of internal reckonings that become exterior, become interior, move away from him, reattach to him, And so we look and we follow him again toward, you know, the unknown future.
So toward the beginning of the episode, we are shown a more hopeful image of what masculinity can look like in the shared friendship between AJ and Pete. So what does or can masculinity look like when it's free from the toxic demands of the patriarchy?
I mean, I think that question organizes many books on the New York Times bestseller list of self-help books. And I think, you know, if we had an answer, I hope that we would be in a different place than we are sociopolitically. But I think, you know, we need to scrap our attachments to these terms and start again. I'm not sure that reforming masculinity is necessarily the way out. And I think, you know, de-investing from these categories and easy attachments to power is one of the only ways forward.
Chase. I'm going to switch here for a second because we are very excited to talk about all of the stuff that you are working on right now. I know that there's probably some stuff that you can't talk about, but what can you talk about? Because our listeners want to know.
Chase, give us the scoop.
Well, I am 3 days from the world premiere of my documentary feature Framing Agnes at Sundance, which is an extraordinary labor of love that I've been working on with a cohort of friends and collaborators for the better part of 7 years, which is about never-before-seen case files that were found in the belly of the UCLA gender clinic from the late 1950s that will soon be available everywhere. There's tons of projects in development that you know, I'll hope to continue talking about as we continue chatting, but really all hands on deck for Agnes these days, and we can't wait to push it out into the world.
That's so dope. We also can't wait. I'm really excited to watch it. Again, I discovered you with the show. I am a huge fan of everything you do. I cannot wait to catch up and see what else you are doing next. I know that our listeners feel the same. Thank you so much for taking this time to sit down and hang out. I know that you are a busy, busy beaver. So thank you so much for taking time to hang out with us.
Likewise. This is amazing.
It was so great to hear from you.
Likewise. Always happy to spend some time. Thank you.
The Chase Joint.
Yo, Chase is like so smart. Such a great interview. Just like boom, boom, boom. And also like doing so much, like going to festivals, directing episodes. Again, as I've mentioned in one of my favorite episodes of last season, Elliot. Chase is Elliot, really so just immaculately amazing. Like he's so good.
He's killing it.
Killing it.
Coming up, we're joined by Josue Arguelles from A Call to Men.
Okay, so Josue, we are so excited to have you join us here to talk about like toxic masculinity and the latest episode of Two Sentence Horror Stories. But before we get into that, please tell us more about the work that you are doing with the organization A Call to Men.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here, Megan and Danielle, for making A Call to Men part of this conversation. And our work is focused on engaging men and boys all across the world, really in how to promote healthy manhood, healthy masculinity, in the efforts to prevent all forms of violence against all women and girls. So we do that through education, trainings, prevention efforts. And a lot of this is also really focused on the younger generation of men, right? Because as our tagline says, it's the next generation of manhood.
Yeah.
That is dope. So obviously this episode deals a lot with like masculinity and like what manhood means and like how different people interpret that. So what services do you offer through A Call to Men to address these issues?
We have 20 plus years experience working with and training men and boys, right? And this includes in educational institutions, corporations, organizations. Also, we've done extensive work with the national professional sports teams, right? So like the NFL, the NBA, NHL. We also do work and training within the military, with the United Nations. So we're just like, you know, we're like we say, from the barbershop to the boardroom. So we're out in communities doing this work with middle school and high school students. And we're also doing this with boardrooms and corporations and companies across the country and the world.
The barbershop is where you kind of learn and get to hear a lot of these like conversations between men and like the way men deal with men. Tell us about your Youth Act and what your initiative and your goals are.
So Youth Act is our youth branch of work, right? So we focus on a cohort annually of young leaders from across the country. And the work for them is really to learn about the foundation of our work, right? About the man box, about the collective socialization of men, but also to shift and expand the conversations on masculinity, right? That masculinity is not just a conversation for men and boys, right? Like queer folks, trans folks, non-binary folks all have stake in how we define masculinity and what that means, right? Like, what does gender even mean?
Coming up, more with our guests. But first, a word from our amazing sponsors. Welcome back to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast. I have to ask this because you said something called the man box. Would you mind? Oh gosh, here's me being a writer. Would you mind unpacking the man box for me?
The man box. So it's a term we've coined at A Call to Men, really. And it's all about how we, as a society, right, as a collective society, have defined masculinity and manhood, and also how we uphold it. So really, it's like all these rigid norms of how men should be, how they should show up, how they should act. And so, you know, that's a box. It's very rigid. Anything outside of that is like what men are not supposed to be, right? So we feel that the man box is really this concept that helps men and boys understand, like, this is very, it's a construct, right? So how do we help you unlearn all that so that you can break out of the man box? Because then you're just your more full, authentic, free self.
I first became, I didn't have a word for this, but the concept of the man box became clear to me when I was a kid, because I have a Puerto Rican dad who in the late 90s loved to order cosmopolitans at restaurants. And this was at the height of Sex in the City. And so all the waiters would always assume it was my mom's cosmopolitan. Like, nobody could wrap their head around a man ordering a cosmopolitan because it was such a girly drink, which is crazy. Like, who made that rule up? He's just Puerto Rican and likes a sweet alcoholic beverage. But that has become seen as like a girl thing. So talk us through your personal journey and what led you to this line of work.
Yeah. And I like that you're bringing that up, Megan, right? It's like these gender norms, right? And these gender norms really, you know, are detrimental to like embracing our full human experience, right? Because then I think back to my journey, and I think back to the journey of like, you know, my abuelo, my dad, my brothers. It's just like falling in line with these rigid gender norms. I think I'm like, so how much of ourselves do we reject at an early age, right? How much of ourselves do we like not embrace because we're like, that's not meant for me, right? As a male identifying person, that space or that toy or that art medium or that that group of people is not meant for me. Right, because I'm stuck in this man box. Not only am I stuck in this man box, but every other male figure in my life does a very good job to keep me in check in that man box. Right.
Yeah,
so the minute I step outside of that, they're like, whoa, what's going on here? Let's get you back in here. Right. So, you know, and that's a journey that I definitely experience. And I think also in, you know, in A Call to Men finding me, I've also been able to just do away with so much of that armor that's just not useful for me anymore.
That's so beautiful. Can you think of one like example of a time when you were, oh, sorry, Danielle, did I steal your amazing
follow-up? I already know that this sounds like a good question.
Okay, yeah, I was just gonna, I love everything you said, but can you think of an example of a time like in the recent past or your growing up experience where you liked something or you wanted to do something or feel something or express something and you were stopped because of the man box?
Oh yeah, absolutely. As a young kid, dancing and theater was all like, oh, I want to do that. I want to be in that, right? And I did to a certain extent, but there was always like, you know, the taunting or the teasing or like, why are you doing that? That's for girls. Or like, you know, harsher words. We know what they say, right, kids? In terms of like challenging or questioning your manhood or your masculinity. And I think, you know, that in itself is also an experience of like, you start to put on like these armors to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. But then what happens with that is that it hardens and it just becomes part of you. And so taking that off as an adult is a big unlearning and undoing process, right?
Oh gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. I sorry. I grew up on military bases. So like, I am very much aware with like toxic masculinity and like how it presents and like other things. First of all, thank you so much for like sharing your experience. This idea that like, if men want to dance or do theater or cheerlead, like you're automatically put in this man box where it's like, well, you have to be this or you can't be that. And like masculinity expresses itself in so many different ways. And so I want to unpack another man box, which is like really what this episode is about. So when you watch Toxic, what did you think about it?
At first, I was just like, whoa, look at all these rigid norms in the man box at play, right?
This is like
collective socialization happening in this episode. It's also like a good... So here's the thing I'll say. It's like also when you do this work about engaging men and boys and getting them to understand, like, how do we break out of this man box? How do you be your full authentic self? What you also realize is as you start to see a lot of this behavior, the language, the mannerisms, because you're in a healing journey, you also start to think like, what is hurting them? Right? Oh. What is hurting them that they are reacting in this way and treating each other in this way?
Danielle's entire heart is exploding. Let's give it a moment.
Thank you.
Exploding hearts. It's good. It's good. It's good. You know, so it really, in the healing journey, you not only call people out, and in particular right now, men, right? There is a place and there is an impact for calling men in our communities and our lives out for behavior, language, that is violent, right? That is damaging. Mm. But it's also like, well, how do I call you in so that we can do better, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking when I was seeing the episode. I'm like, how can we talk to these young men about calling each other in?
Oh, that's such a wonderful, inclusive, non-horror impulse, because that's not what we do in horror. We punish it. So we've been talking, the episode's called Toxic. We've been saying toxic masculinity. Can you tell us what exactly is toxic masculinity? And I'm going to put on my uneducated hat, like I don't know, and say some things I've heard, which is like, so do you hate all men? Does toxic masculinity mean being a man is toxic?
Yeah, I'll share this, right? Toxic masculinity is language that we use. As a society, is the language that connects when we're trying to have these conversations with men and boys? Not all the time, right?
Yeah.
I think there's moments in which that works for folks to understand what we're talking about. But at a call to men, I will share that we don't use the phrasing toxic masculinity, right? We stick really to healthy, unhealthy manhood and what that means, because toxic to us is a binary of like, we can define what's toxic. And then if you have men and boys are like, well, I don't do that, so I'm not toxic. But it's more than that, right? We know it's more than that. It's about like these teachings, the emotional literacy, and how do we show up as just full authentic human beings for each other?
Yes. And so let me rephrase my own question to call people in. Can you tell us what unhealthy manhood looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So unhealthy manhood comes in various forms, right? And first of all, it's talking about how we do harm to ourselves, right? It's the patriarchy, that we live in a male-dominated society, and that if we choose to uphold it, that comes at the expense of other people, right? In particular, women, girls, non-binary individuals, queer individuals, trans folks. So It's unhealthy in the forms that we communicate with each other, how we try to check each other. You know, the whole thing with the boys in the episode, like, you're not down, or like, why are you always being such a crybaby, right? It's it's the language, like
that part
that is unhealthy, right? And so for us, it's really, how do we get men and boys to unlearn all that and do healthy masculinity with each other? With each other, but also for yourself, right? How do you do that for yourself?
That's so important, because I think for men too, the emphasis is always on how your actions affect others, and that inner life is so important. Love that. So did you find the way that Pete and the other characters, his other friends, do you find the way that they handled themselves realistic? And like, would young guys like Pete and his friends actually behave how they did in those circumstances? Just, you know, you deal with young men all the time. Like, did that ring true to you?
Absolutely, right? It's like how they hold each other in check in the man box, right? We often say that the man box, what really holds it together is homophobia, right? Because yes. Anything outside of the man box that's not like, oh, but that's not how men are supposed to show up or behave or act, it's gay. Right. It's like, you must be this because you're outside of that. And it doesn't fit what, you know, for me registers as like what men show up as. And then I keep saying what men and boys show up as, which means that masculinity as a whole is performative. It's all performative.
That was the word I was thinking. You're so smart.
Because if we're teaching, educating boys, like, this is how men show up and this is how men handle things, that's a performance. We're letting them know, like, this is how you're supposed to perform, right? Because it has clout, because it has a false sense of safety, right?
Well, and we all have role models, right? And like, we don't know what we don't know. So if your dad, who is your hero, behaves a certain way, you're going to behave like your dad. You're not going to be like, I'm six. Are you in a man box? Like, we follow the scripts we're taught, right? So that makes so much. So it's the self-policing aspect of the episode really rang true to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the piece that you just mentioned right now, you know, especially when we're dealing with men in our lives, right? Whether it's our brothers, our uncles, our dads, our grandfathers, it's tricky, right? Because we start to negotiate that peace with them of like, well, he's doing like harmful things and like behaviors that like are in the man box, but he's my dad, you know, like he just grew up in a different era. And like, we start to kind of negotiate parts of our relationships with them, right? And so I think the policing part for us is really like, we have to be able to like call them out and then call them in, right? Like, this is not an indictment on men. It's an invitation to have a conversation of how to show up in a better way.
So true. So true. Yeah, it reminds me of this part in the episode. It happens a few times where Pete wants to call the cops.
We need to call the cops, okay? Come clean about everything that's happened.
You breathe a word about what happened here tonight to anyone, and I'll tell the cops that hiding AJ's body was your idea.
You know, every horror movie, you're like, just call it. Just figure it out. Just don't make another worse choice. But there's so much resistance in the group that he doesn't. So why do you think they resisted what seems in our horror fan minds the easiest solution? And what do you think would have happened if they did call the cops?
Ooh, I was waiting to dive
into
this one.
Let's get into the cops of it, honey. Let's get into it.
There's a couple things happening here. I think the resistance to calling the cops, especially for this group of young boys, which I also want to be like recognized and lift, right? It's a group of young white boys, right? And so the calling the cops, I think, especially as like youth, as teenagers, I think there's a resistance to like, I don't want to get in trouble, right? I don't want to get caught for this. There's also the piece around, I forget if it was either Jeremy or Brendan that mentioned, we're from the crappy part of the tracks or town or something, right? So there was this kind of like, you know, we have financial challenges or we're financially poor. So our experience with police interaction is going to be maybe a little bit different than someone who's coming from an affluent neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
So there are those two pieces. And then I think it also is different in how some folks may experience police as serve and protect, where in other communities that may be Black and brown, police is going to be policing, not necessarily serve and protect.
So, yeah, as you said, we're lifting up or calling in this group of young, but they are white, and not but, they are young, they are white, they are men. So what role does that privilege play in that cop debate? What role does that play when the ranger shows up and reacts to them? How does intersectionality play a role in not just young white men, but also Black and brown men? And how they are socialized and treated and expected to show up both in front of law enforcement and each other.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, when the ranger, the security showed up, you know, it was very like, let me ask questions, let me look around. There wasn't really like, there wasn't a sense of urgency of like, something's
what
wrong
here. What are you guys
up to? Yeah.
Oh, like, your definitely... tire's weird? I'm just going to kind of like casually look inside your camper. Like, it's totes cool. Y'all are fine. Nothing is weird. It smells like dead bodies in here, but that might be poop.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Wes at some point was just like, oh, can you tell us about the ghosts in these woods? And she's just like, oh,
well, you're,
yeah, of course.
You're not supposed to be here, but I will totally tell you about the ghosts that you're not supposed to be here for.
Right. It's just like a very surface question. And then, you know, that she receives an answer and then lets it go. I'm like, that's definitely not the experience. Had this been like, you know, an outing with Black and brown boys. And, you know, that connects to our work in, you know, we engage all men and boys, right? Mm-hmm. But we also are very intentional that how we show up in a space with predominantly white young men is not the same way we're going to show up in a space with predominantly Black and brown Indigenous men, right?
Right, right.
Because although the collective male socialization is real across the board for male identified folks, there's also very critical differences in when we're talking about, you know, culture and race and class and gender identities, and more importantly, trauma, right? Historical, intergenerational, and personal trauma. Because how we address that and how we uplift that with Black and brown boys is very critical for how we can connect with them in a more real way and in a more intentional way, right? So we do believe we have to do our work intersectional and with intersectionality. And I can't mention that word without lifting up Kimberly Crenshaw.
Thank you. Yes, that, absolutely.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So having watched this, what do you think about what this episode says about the cycle of violence and how it perpetuates?
So I would say it's a cycle of consequences,
ooh,
right? The cycle of consequences that if we don't interrupt, then it's just like the next generation continues to like hang on to these teachings and perpetrate that violence, right? And it's fitting that they're in the woods, because we use this kind of analogy of like, you know, we don't want to do intervention work, right? Like where these boys are already in the river drowning. It's just like, right, we want to do prevention work. How do we go upstream to find out why are they falling in there in the first place, right? And how do we interrupt that at that point before they're already downstream? And then we're talking about intervention.
I love that.
Oh my God. Yo, literally, thank you so much. Hostway, I literally could talk to you about this forever. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is a really important conversation, and you are so dope, and the work you're using is so dope.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for finding ways to present these ideas that are about hope and the idea that we can have hope. You can find more information on Youth Act, as well as all the other wonderful things A Call to Men does, at acalltomen.org and on Instagram at acalltomen, all one word, or Youth Act Worldwide, all one word.
Thank you, Josue, flexing my heart muscle in appreciation.
Thank you for having us on.
Danielle, what a fantastic conversation with Josue Arguelles from A Call to Men.
Yo, the work they are doing over there is so incredibly important. I do think that being able to intervene to find ways to teach masc folks how to turn from an unhealthy idea of masculinity to a healthy idea of masculinity is like so important. And I'm so grateful that someone is doing the work. And he's so smart.
I love it. Instead of calling people out, we're calling them in.
Call them in.
So thank you also to Chase Joint and Josue Arguelles for with A Call to Men for today's much needed, much appreciated conversation.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts so you never miss an episode.
Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast is a Stage 13 original series hosted by me, Daniel Radford.
And me, Megan Rosati. Don't forget to watch Season 3 of Two Sentence Horror Stories on the CW and CWTV.com and stream Seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix.
Check out more on the show at stage13.com and be sure to follow Two Sentence Horror Stories on Instagram at Two Sentence Horror Stories for the latest updates on the podcast and show and on our Facebook page at Two Sentence Horror Stories to connect with other fans of the show and share your thoughts on this season.